PhD in astronomy from the University of Toronto and a BA in physics from the University of British Columbia. He's the founder and president of Reasons to Believe. He's the author of a whole lot of books, somewhere around 14 now, is that correct? Many of which can be found on the book table back there. Colleen, raise your hand. That's Colleen. She's wonderful. She sells books. Go buy some books from her. My name is Ross Hoagland. My only claim to fame is that I've been listening to Hugh for about 12 years, and it has incredibly increased my faith, not only that the God of the Bible is real, that he is tangible, but that he also wants a personal relationship with each of us. It's not just in my head that there is a God, but he has taken over my heart too. And it was understanding him from a scientific point of view that he really is there, when it made sense intellectually to me, then I could open my heart to him. So that's been my path. And so that's why I'm so loyal to Hugh and to this class, because it's made more of a difference in my walk than anyone else I've ever met. There's a card on your seat. A couple of things. If you fill the card out, you get a free gift. It's a CD. DVD? CD. What is it? It's a book giveaway. That's right. You fill it out, and we're going to do a drawing somewhere in the middle here, and we'll give away some of Dr. Ross's books. So please fill that out. There's also a little note there. Next week, a week from tomorrow night, is the next meeting of the Reasons to Believe LA chapter, and we're going through Dr. Ross's Why is the Universe the Way It Is video series. It's about, each segment is about 20 minutes long, and then we do a Q&A. Last time the Q&A lasted about an hour and a half, and I had to kick everybody out because it was 9 o'clock and we were still going. It was really, really fun and a lot of very exciting. Why the Universe is the Way It Is deals with questions like, why is it so big? Why is it so massive? The physical characteristics that the universe has are all required for human life to exist. And it's pretty cool. So I want to invite everybody a week from tomorrow night, again in room 154 across the alley at 7 o'clock. Well, let's pray, and we'll bring up Dr. Hugh Ross. Lord God, we're so excited to be here this morning, to be able to hear about how you can speak to us through the natural world, and how one of the ways that we can worship you is through science and through philosophy. And the more we know about it all, the more we realize how humble we should be, because you created it all and you put it all together. And we thank you so much for your Son, Jesus Christ. We thank you for these people that are here this morning. Lord, we ask that the questions that are asked and the answers just edify you. Thank you, and bless each of us as we go our way this afternoon. In Jesus' name, amen. Everybody, welcome Dr. Hugh Ross.
Now let's see if this microphone is working. Testing 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. No. Let me try this. Testing. Oh, we gotta turn it on. How's that? 3.14159265. That's as far as I can go.
We need.
All right.
The way this is going to work, folks, is Hugh's got a couple of scientific discoveries that he's going to talk about that provide evidence for the God of the Bible. And as soon as somebody gets up to the microphone, he'll start taking questions. So hurry up. Go over there.
Right. And we kind of do that about twice a month in the paradoxes class. We'll start the class off with some scientific discovery that pertains to faith issues. And so I brought an example here, but the way it works, as soon as someone gets behind the microphone, I stop talking about the latest science and we deal with your questions. So it's just trying to get things going. But one of the more amazing measurements was made a few weeks ago. And what you see here is a temperature curve for the universe. We live in a Big Bang universe, and one of the characteristics of a Big Bang universe is that as it expands, it gets colder and colder as time goes on. And what you see there, that black curve, is actually the cooling curve you get from what the Bible states about the characteristics of the universe. And I'll explain to you in a few minutes how you get that curve from the Bible. But what you see overlapping that curve are 14 different measurements of the past temperature of the universe. Now, it's quite easy to, well, if you've got the right equipment, it's straightforward to measure the present temperature of the universe. In fact, it's now been measured to 6 places of a decimal. If you want to know what the temperature of the universe is right now, it's 2.72548 degrees above absolute zero. And you say, what's the error bar in that? 0.00057 degrees. So it's known quite accurately. But the challenge is to measure the temperature of the universe at some significant look-back time in the history of the universe. And what astronomers do is they'll look, say, 5, 6, 10, 12 billion light years away, and they'll find a gas cloud in a very bright galaxy or quasar, and they'll look for spectral lines that are excited by the cosmic background temperature, the temperature left over from the cosmic creation event. And by that means, they can determine that, say, 5, 6, 8, 10, 12 billion years ago, the universe indeed was quite a bit hotter than it is right now. But these spectral lines are difficult to measure with any precision, and a breakthrough that was announced just a few weeks ago in the Astrophysical Journal is that we've been able at one epoch to measure it with high precision. In fact, what you see in the graph there are, you know, you see measurements at the current here, which is 13.8 billion years after the cosmic creation event, but as we go back in the history of the universe, you notice that the error bars get bigger and bigger the farther back you go in time. And when you get really far back, the error bars get quite large. Now, what's new is that measurement you see in the middle when the universe is about 7 billion years old. And you see that little red dot there? You can't see the error bar. The error bar is so tiny, it's completely obliterated by that little red dot. So for the first time, astronomers have been able to get an accurate measure of the past temperature of the universe with high precision, and it perfectly fits the biblically predicted cooling curve for the universe. Now, there is one external point you need to know to get this biblically predicted curve. You do need to know the age of the universe. But if you know the age of the universe, then you get the rest of it. But for the first time, we actually have a very accurate confirmation of the biblically predicted curve. Now, if you want the actual measurements, this was done at a redshift of a 0.89, which corresponds to a distance of 6.4 billion light years, which means we're seeing this particular galaxy 6.4 billion years ago. So we're measuring the temperature of the universe 6.4 billion years ago, and the measured temperature was 5.08 degrees above absolute zero, plus or minus a tenth of a degree, and the biblically predicted temperature is 5.14 degrees. So you can see how closely they match. And by the way, I was wrong. It's not the Astrophysical Journal. It's the European Journal Astronomy and Astrophysics. And that's the actual paper. You can go online and find it and see it for yourself. And if you don't want to go online, I've actually got the paper right here. You can come up front afterwards and take a look at it. Stefan Mueller is the fellow who led the team that made this measurement. Something else that got published literally just days ago is a group of researchers that said, now that we have the Planck satellite data on the cosmic background radiation, we can actually look at the way electrons interact with the photons in that cosmic background radiation, something called the Sunyaev-Zeldovich effect, and that will actually give us measurements of the past temperature of the universe that are accurate to better than 1% precision. This one is accurate at 2% precision. So literally, it won't be long before we have measurements that are even more precise. Now, some of you might want to know where you get this out of the Bible. Well, you get it from a whole set of statements. I mean, the first book I read in cosmology was when I was 7 years of age by Fred Hoyle. He comes from a Hindu worldview perspective, but what he said about the Bible is that it has amazing content on cosmology. It says a lot about cosmology. Well, when I began to go through the world's holy books, I discovered it says 10 times as much about the universe as all the rest of the world's holy books combined. And it says 4 things repeatedly. It says a lot more than this, but these are the 4 things that the Bible speaks about with great repetition. That the universe comes out of a singularity beginning, which means the beginning of all matter, energy, space, and time. That it continuously expands from that beginning under constant laws of physics, where one of those laws is a pervasive law of decay. Now, I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this, but here are a few of the passages that talk about the singularity beginning. Genesis 1:1, in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth, the Shamayan Ares, which refers to all matter, energy, space, and time. Hebrews 1:3, the universe we can detect did not come from that which we can detect, which means it had to come from beyond matter, energy, space, and time. And the Bible stands alone as the only holy book that says that space and time don't exist until God creates this universe. And then from that space-time beginning, we have this stretching out of the heavens. 11 different passages speak about how God expands the universe from the cosmic creation event and expands it under constant laws of physics. 7 places in the Bible it tells us that the laws of physics that God established at the cosmic creation event will not change. At least they won't change until God permanently removes all evil and suffering, and how one of those laws is a pervasive law of decay. Hence, the universe must get colder and colder in a highly predictable way. You all understand that? Well, all of those of you who remember being taught about the second law of thermodynamics will readily recognize what the Bible is saying, or what you call the law of entropy, or what some of you may now recognize as Murphy's Law. Everything decays. Well, if we are living in a universe where everything is subject to decay, then any system that expands must get colder and colder in a predictable way. Most of you probably got here by automobile. That's the principle in which your automobile engine works. The piston chamber, when it expands, brings the temperature of the gasoline down to a point where it will no longer ignite. But when the piston chamber compresses, it pushes the temperature up to a point where it can ignite. And if you've got a diesel engine, you don't even need a spark plug because the piston chamber will compress enough to ignite the gasoline. That principle applies to everything. So in a universe that continuously expands, it must get colder and colder. And if it expands from a space-time beginning, it starts off with near infinitely hot temperature. But as it expands, the temperature declines and becomes cooler and cooler, and hence you wind up with this curve. So what we see here in this curve is that according to the Bible, the temperature of the universe would begin infinitely hot or near infinitely hot, and then it would, as the physicists would claim, adiabatically cool over the history of the universe. So that's how you get that curve. That's what the Bible predicts about the past temperature of the universe, and you can see that it is a fit. In fact, for the first time, we can declare it's a perfect fit, or at least a perfect fit within 2% precision. So that's the very latest piece of evidence supporting what the Bible teaches about the creation and the one that brought the universe into existence. I now see somebody behind the microphone. I see that it is Dave, which means that he's got a written question.
No, actually, it's my own personal question.
It's your own personal question. All right.
The moon has obviously been in the news here lately, and so I was wondering if you could tell us a little about what a supermoon is. And I believe I've heard you say in the past once or twice that obviously when we say our prayers, we should give thanks for the moon. Maybe you could tell us why.
Sure. Well, a supermoon, if you missed it, it happened last night.
So.
Although tonight it'll be pretty good as well. And what a supermoon is, see, the moon as it orbits the Earth does not have a perfectly circular orbit. And because that's true of all bodies that orbit. Our Earth orbits about the sun in what's called an elliptical orbit. And likewise, the moon orbits the Earth with an elliptical orbit, which means there are times when the moon is closer to the Earth than other times. And a supermoon is when the Earth is closer, the moon is closest to the Earth at the time that it's a full moon. And last night, we had a supermoon. How often does that happen? Oh, maybe about once every dozen years you'll get it. And some supermoons are better than others. There was a supermoon, I think, 2-3 years ago that was actually a little bit more spectacular than this, but hey, by 1% or 2%. So, but hey, I looked at it last night and I could tell that it was noticeably larger in the sky than normally what it would be. And so that also means if you got a supermoon, you can have a minor moon, where the moon is full when it's farthest away from the Earth. And so it will look a little bit smaller. See, what's the difference? Oh, it's about 7% total between the small moon and the supermoon. So you kind of got to be watching the sky to notice the difference. Now, why is the moon so important for life here on Earth? Well, what's interesting about the moon, or what's unique about the moon, is how massive it is compared to the mass of planet Earth. I mean, there are 178 moons in our solar system, but our moon, in terms of its mass relative to its planet's mass, is 50 times bigger than any other moon in the solar system. And the reason why it is so big compared to its planet, it didn't form in the ordinary way. Our moon formed as a result of two planets sharing the orbit of the Earth. Planet Earth, which was about the size of Venus at the time, and another planet which was twice the size of Mars. And what happened is that the smaller of the two planets had a slow collision with the Earth, and it was that slow collision that led to the formation of the moon. If you want to read about the details, I got a series of 6 articles on our reasons.org website which talks about the miracle of the formation of the moon. But the bottom line is we wind up with this gigantic moon orbiting our small planet relatively close. And because it's not very far away and because it is so big relative to our planet, it prevents the rotation axis of our planet from tilting back and forth. So, for example, with Mars, its rotation axis tilts back and forth by about 60 degrees. That's why you don't see a big polar ice cap on Mars, because it will tilt and the ice there gets exposed to warmer temperatures and immediately disappears to outer space. But a new polar cap will form as a result of comets delivering frozen water. So that explains why Mars has such a very thin ice cap on it, because it's not stable, whereas with the Earth, our ice cap is stable. And it's because our rotation axis doesn't flip back and forth that you're able to have advanced life on planet Earth. The other thing that the moon has done is that it's actually so big, it's on the very top end of the mass to keep our polar axis stable. If it was only about 2% more massive, then we would no longer have a stable tilt of our rotation axis. So as a British astronomer that asked the question in a journal article, why is it that our moon is at the very upper limit of what's needed to stabilize the tilt of our rotation axis? And what he discerned is this collision event actually caused the rotation rate of the Earth to speed up. And so when this collision event took place, we wound up with a rotation period somewhere between 2 and 4 hours a day, which would not be pleasant for advanced life. If you're a bacterium, no big deal. But if you're a horse or a cow, that would be a problem. Or a human being, even more of a problem. So it's necessary to have a moon massive enough that it would slow the rotation period down in a space of only about 4.25 billion years. And so, and the point there is, there's an extremely narrow time window in which humans can exist here on planet Earth. And it's crucial to slow down our rotation rate to 24 hours a day right when we meet that window. And that literally takes a moon as massive as it is. And believe it or not, there's 20 more features of the moon that must be fine-tuned to make it possible for us human beings to thrive here on planet Earth. So yeah, when our family celebrates Thanksgiving, we thank God for the moon. We have someone else at the back there. Go ahead.
Hi. This isn't as science-driven as you'd probably prefer. But I was just wondering, as a young person who, I'm in my 20s and relatively educated, a lot of my friends, I would venture to say most, don't believe in God or don't believe in, you know, most are atheists, don't subscribe to the idea of going to church or having a religion. I was just wondering how you think we can get more young people interested in subscribing to religion and the idea of more than just us out there.
Okay, good question. How can we get young people more interested in even pursuing this idea about whether or not you know, there's a God out there and religious matters? Well, it says in Hebrews 11:6 that in order to come to God, we must believe that He exists and that He rewards those who earnestly seek Him. The problem is with the new generations that are coming up, they don't believe that. They need to be persuaded that there actually is a God out there. And not only is there a God, but it's a God that actually wants to reward those who earnestly seek them. I can remember 40, 50 years ago where most Americans accepted that. And you could pick up from there and take them through the four spiritual laws. But now you got the problem is that most people don't believe the first of the four spiritual laws. Now, what the Bible tells us is we're to use the book of nature as a way to persuade people that there is a God out there who exists and wants to reward those that earnestly seek them. So that's kind of what we do in the paradoxes class. We take the book of nature and use it as a tool to bring people to the book of Scripture, and it works the other way around too, where you can use the book of Scripture to assist the development of the research of the book of nature. And so, for example, the scientific community owes a huge weight of debt to the Bible, because it was the Bible that that described in some detail what we now call the scientific method. And it's no accident that the scientific revolution exploded out of Reformation Europe. And so a biblical perspective will help you to do better science. And that's something I do with my fellow scientists, is show them how a biblical worldview perspective will make them more productive as a scientist. So it works both ways. But it does mean that we're going to need to be active in bringing people to the book of Scripture. And you say, well, shouldn't that be easier today? Because look how much more science we know. But here's the problem. Most people today live in cities. And when you're living in cities, you're kind of cut off to a large degree from the book of nature. And it's something I've noticed that when I travel into rural areas, I don't have to persuade them that God exists and wants to reward them. They kind of know that just because of their exposure to nature. It's people living in cities that need to be persuaded of that. And that would include people with PhDs in science. A PhD in science doesn't necessarily mean that you're close enough to nature that you're going to be able to see this. So, for example, when I was on the faculty at Caltech, I would make it a point to take my fellow scientists up into the high Sierras, where they would see nature all around them. And it kind of provided an environment where we could talk about the scientific evidence. Whereas at Caltech, inside kind of an ivory tower office, it just wasn't working as well. And I'd have to use things like the Astrophysical Journal. Well, that works, as you can see just today, just taking some of the latest scientific discoveries. And the point here is this. If scientifically the evidence for the God of the Bible gets greater and greater as more and more science is published, then isn't that strong evidence that indeed there is a God exists that wants to reward those that diligently seek them? But part of our role at Reasons to Believe is actually to show people how indeed the more we learn about science, the more evidence we uncover. So, good question.
Hugh, can I take a shot at that too?
Sure.
Also, if you could expand on what you mean by the book of nature. I had somebody just come back here and tell me, you know, what do you mean by the book of nature? Could you just expand on that, please? It's a term you use, but not everybody's familiar with it.
Well, the book of nature is equivalent to the scientific record. You know, what do you see out there in the universe? The Bible says the heavens declare the glory of God, the heavens declare His righteousness. In the book of Job, it tells us, look to the birds, look to the beasts. They'll teach you things about God. So that's why I think it's always good when you have children that you expose them to pets, but not just these highly bred pets, actually let them see these birds and mammals in their wild context, which is why I made it a point when my sons were growing up to take them out into places where the animals hadn't been exposed to a lot of human beings. Of course, they complained about how hard the hike was, but hey.
I want to try to answer your question, too. People your age, not my age, sort of, it's changed. We live in a postmodern world, and in a postmodern world, the belief is there is no absolute truth. But there is another side to Christianity besides our intellectual side, and that is there is an emotional and experiential side. God promises us not just head knowledge, but He promises us the radical idea of a changed life if we develop a relationship with Him. And I know in this culture, people under 30, people under 40, wherever that line is, a lot of them don't believe in God. They don't have that foundation of what that can mean. And I think that can be the radical message, too, that you can have a changed life through Jesus Christ. You can experience a relationship with Jesus Christ, with the God of the universe. And I would think to someone who doesn't believe in absolute truth, there's still that appeal, because a lot of people's lives are really empty. This hookup culture where things happen so quickly and so easy, without that foundation of God that we've always had in this country, a lot of people are really, really empty. And so with some people, you can start there and then go to the science.
Well, let me say something about the science, too, that's different. You know, when I was educated in science, you had to take a course in the physical sciences. What I've now discovered on the university campus, you can get a degree, you can get a master's degree, you can even get a doctoral degree without ever taking a single course in the physical sciences. Now, here's the problem. For 6 days, God creates. On the seventh day, He stops creating. And so if you're a young person who's maybe taken a course in biology or anthropology, but not a course in chemistry, physics, and you've never taken a course in calculus, then your exposure in terms of the book of nature is seventh day, predominantly. And notice what the Bible says about the seventh day. God stops His work of creation activity, which means all you're going to see in your science is natural process. It explains why the majority of scientists say we see no evidence for the supernatural handiwork of a creator. Well, if you're doing biology in the human era, you will not see that evidence, because God stopped creating when He created Eve. So all we see today is natural process. But it also explains why so many astronomers, mathematicians, and physicists are believers, because for many of them, their data comes from the 6 days, not the seventh day. I mean, when I was at Caltech, all of my research was on galaxies and quasars. Well, guess what? All of them are far enough away that it takes light a lot more time than the human era to reach our telescopes, and therefore we see the handiwork of God everywhere. And so when I spoke at the National Observatory in Tokyo, half of the astronomers that showed up for my talk told me they were already Christians. Half of the other half told me they were studying the Bible to become Christians. Now, that's in a nation that's less than 2% Christian. And what these astronomers all told me when I asked them, what is it that brought you to the Christian faith? They all said the anthropic principle. We look at the universe, we see design everywhere. We see the design at such an extremely exquisite level that it testifies of the Christian God, not the Buddhist God, or the Hindu God, or the Shinto God. And so they began to go out and get Bibles. So remember, for 6 days, God creates. But it's different today. Most young people who graduate have never taken a course in physics or chemistry or geology or geophysics, and probably have not taken a course in calculus either.
We've got another question, Hugh.
Morning, Dr. Ross. I think God is still resting. This is probably still in the seventh day. I have an observation that Anyhow, I had a little something I wanted to read, just a paragraph from a book I'd finished reading. It's by a by Kevin Nelson, MD. He's a neurologist, done a lot of research in the brain, and this is what his comment. He says, "Our sense of reality is fragile. If my arm can be alien to me or seem to still exist even after it is removed, if a rubber appendage can be my flesh and blood, if I can sprout new limbs from my body, can I trust the seeing reality of an out-of-body experience? Are the revelatory changes in one's sense of self during the spiritual experiences just kindred illusions? If the self can be thought of as a figment of one's of our imagination, could the same be said of spiritual truth?" This is probably the latest thing on brain research. What do you think of that? I mean, we talk all this thing about what happened in the world and all that, what's happened to us. But now we're beginning to find out that all this stuff that we believe doesn't happen in our heart, doesn't happen anywhere but in our brain.
Well,
and
first
this tells
off,
us that the brain can be fooled.
Yeah. First off, I agree with your starting statement that God is still at rest. And so we're still in God's seventh day of rest, which means that we're not going to see miracles of creation today. It doesn't mean we won't see miracles in other arenas, but we won't see miracles of creation. However, the seventh day will end. Three times in the Bible it tells us we're presently in the seventh day. Hebrews 4, Psalm 95, and John 5. But also tells us an eighth day is coming when God will create again, referring to the new creation. And what God does during the seventh day, he ceases from his work of creation activity and targets the problem of evil. So God's goal in the seventh day is to eliminate evil once and for all. So he's doing miracles in the spirit realm, but not in the physical realm. But the question that was asked there is, to what degree can we trust a spiritual phenomena? The Bible tells us that we are physical beings, that we're soulish beings, we have feelings, we have a will, we have a free will, and we have a mind. But in addition to that, we have a spirit. Or the way the book of Job puts it, God designed the birds and the mammals to serve and please us, a higher species. But he designed us to serve him, a higher being. Which is one reason why he told us, look to these birds and these mammals. They'll teach you things about yourself and about God. As they were created to serve a higher species, we were created to serve a higher being. And there's actually scientific experiments that are bringing that point out. New experiments, I mean, what amazes me as a scientist is we got Charles Darwin making claims in 1871 in his book, The Descent of Man, where he claims that we're just simply advanced animals, that there's nothing distinctive about human beings. We're just an advanced kind of a monkey, if you like. A little more intelligent, but we don't differ with them by degree. And until 4 years ago, no scientist challenged that presumption. But what's happening in the scientific literature, they're now performing experiments that are showing that we human beings indeed are unique, that we have qualities that the animals don't have, particularly in the spirit realm, that the animals can't manifest. We're the only ones that are aware of right and wrong and morality. We're the only ones that are capable of responding to symbols. But, you know, it is true that you've got neuroscientists and neuropsychologists that are bringing out these books where they make the point that all this spirituality that human beings claim to experience is simply a figment of imagination, and that we really can't trust any deductions of the human mind. Now, the irony of all that is these articles have been written by people who think that their mind actually is capable of discerning truth. Otherwise, why bother to publish? And to me, that's the fundamental flaw in Darwinian evolution. You know, if our minds are the product of pure chance, then that means we can't trust anything our minds produce. On the other hand, there's been a long history of scientific advance that confirms that indeed what we learn from the book of nature through our human minds is indeed trustworthy. Now, I would admit that the trustworthiness factor diminishes when you're talking about sociology and economics, but it's very high when you're in what are called the simple sciences of mathematics, physics, and astronomy. You know, there's a reason why math works, and there's a reason why our human mind is able to do mathematics. We live in a universe where everything is consistent and harmonious, and God has given us a mind that is capable of discerning truth from error. But to me, this is the irony of these books that are coming out that are literally claiming that our minds are not trustworthy. Now, on that basis, there is also the question about, you know, how do we evaluate near-death experiences? Well, I've been evaluating near-death experiences for well over 30 years, and I would encourage you to be skeptical. Most people come to me with a claim of a near-death experience. It turns out not to be a real near-death experience. After all, we are psychological beings, and we have human biases and motives, and it's easy for us to imagine things. And you know, a near-death experience isn't the same thing as doing an experiment in a physics lab. Usually you're asleep or in a coma, and you know, when the human mind gets oxygen deprived, you hallucinate, and hallucinations can look very real. And as it tells us in the Bible, when it comes to spiritual experiences, test the spirits to see where they're coming from. And there's three places a spiritual experience can come from. It can come from within the human being. In other words, I can psychologically manifest that experience. And if I've got a poor self-image, for example, there's a pretty high probability that's what's going on. So for an example, I interview someone who's having a near-death experience. I first ask a lot of questions about their psychological state, because if they're trying to push up their self-worth, that could be a powerful motivation to have this gee whiz experience. But also, when it tells us to test the spirits, we are warned in the Bible we're not the only spiritual beings God has created. He has created angels who are not subject to the space-time manifold of the universe and its laws of physics, and we human beings who are. But God has granted these angels the power to come into a realm and leave a realm. Notice they don't stay, but they can come and go. And so it's possible that this spiritual experience you're having is not coming from God, it's not coming from within your psyche, it's coming from these angels. And they come in two categories, those that are submitted to God's authority and those in a rebellion to God's authority. And also warns us the ones that are in rebellion will appear as angels of righteousness. Their goal is to deceive. So it's crucial that we be skeptical. Now, I'll give you some rough numbers. Of all the people that come to me with these near-death experiences, about 90% of them are psychologically induced, either through some medical trauma or through some need for psychological fulfillment. About 5%, I would say, are being brought about through angels that are in rebellion against God, and a 5% are the real thing. Now, if you want to hear about the real thing, we interviewed a medical doctor, I think his name is Dr. Sabone, on our reasons.org website. It's still up there. It was a two-hour interview we had with him, and he's a medical researcher that decided to put this to the test. They did such things as testing this idea that when people are near death, they float out of their body and are actually above their body. And so they did experiments where they would put messages on the girders above the operating table and see if people really floated up high enough where they could read the message. Because, you know, they're not going to be able to do that unless they actually get above the level of the operating table. And so there's actually experiments that document that these experiences in rare cases are real.
Can I say something on that, Hugh?
Sure.
It brings up an interesting question. Is there a way to test near-death experiences scientifically? And what Hugh's saying is that almost all near-death experiences are induced from within us or from the spirit world, spiritual world, but there are times, there are rare times when people's experience in a near-death experience correlates with reality. They see something in the operating room or even in another room that actually happened. And I think that for me, that's really strong evidence that this is a real experience. You can't, what are the chances that your dream or something, some idea that you're making up in your head is going to correspond exactly with what's really happening? And there's been more and more of this in the scientific literature, some of it in peer-reviewed journals. There's hundreds and hundreds of these pieces of evidence where people actually see something that really happened. So, to me, I don't see any other way that you can explain that scientifically. They left their body, they saw it, they came back into their body, and they remembered it, which means part of our memory has got to be in our spiritual side, not just in our physical side.
Okay, it's noon right now, and you see these little cards you got on your table? Please fill them out, because in a few minutes, we're going to do a drawing for two DVDs and a book. So if you can be taking care of that, while we take the next question. Go ahead.
I've probably committed every of the seven deadly sins and broken probably every commandment. Now, I was raised Jewish, but I'm basically consider myself still agnostic. I guess that's the safe place to be for me right now. But I've laid at night in bed saying, and I have to preface it with a big if there's a God out there, and if Jesus is who he says he is, I welcome you guys into my life in the Holy Spirit and help me, because right now I don't like my life, I don't like me, I don't like, and I'm just wondering, is that good enough? Does that mean I won't burn in hell for eternity? Or because I feel like I'm almost burning in hell right now. So I don't know. I mean, I've asked. I haven't felt any changes. And before you answer that, I did make a prayer last night, and I was hoping it was going to come true today. I was going to ask, I'm looking for a job, if there's any job offers. Okay, but other than that. I'm curious. I don't know what to do. I'm kind of confessing, and I just like to know what the answer is.
Well, good question. And, we said earlier that the first step to coming into a relationship with the creator of the universe is recognizing that he actually does exist. And not only does he exist, he wants to reward you in some specific way. So that's step one. So the question I would ask is, are you convinced in your mind that indeed there is such a God? And if you're convinced in your mind, then it's the book of Scripture. And if you actually read carefully what it says in the book of Job, it also testifies of this in the book of nature. Namely, and when you look at nature, you recognize that this God must be incredibly intelligent when you just see how beautifully put together everything in nature is. And you also recognize it must be a very loving God because of how everything kind of fits together. I mean, what you see is optimal relationships, for example, between the carnivores, the herbivores, the detrivores, and the parasites. And you realize that we're living in an incredibly beautiful place. God didn't have to make the earth as beautiful as it is. He didn't have to make food taste as good as it tastes. He didn't have to make relationships as fulfilling as they evidently can be. And so we see an extravagance in what God has provided. And also recognize that this must be a very powerful God. I mean, it says, look to the heavens. There's 50 billion trillion stars there. Every one of those stars has to exist in order for us to be able to thrive here on planet Earth. So if God is that powerful and that intelligent and knowledgeable and that loving, then he must have a solution to a human dilemma. Because it was Job who made the point that God has written a law on our hearts. And it's a law we can't obey. No matter how hard you try, your conscience screams at you that you're falling short of God's moral standard. I mean, I love what you said at the microphone. You know, the seven deadly sins, I've committed them all. What's true of every one of us? Every one of us in our hearts has committed those seven deadly sins. That's the message of the third Sermon on the Mount, where Jesus says, you may not have done these things, but you thought them. And that is enough to make you guilty before an all-holy God who cannot tolerate even the slightest bit of immorality. But what Job concluded was this, is yes, I'm in this hopeless situation where I can't live up to God's standard. But God is all-powerful. He's all-loving. He's all-knowledgeable. And in His great love, He would want to make a solution to my problem. He's got the power to do it, and He's certainly got the knowledge and the intellect to pull it off. And that's why Job was able to say before any piece of Scripture existed, I know my Redeemer lives, and I will see Him on the last day. I know He is loving enough to bring about a bridge whereby I can come into relationship. If you actually read the first few chapters of Job, he recognized that the creator of the universe himself must be the one that redeems humanity from their hopeless situation. I know that my Redeemer lives. He knew it was God himself. And he says, because I'm putting my trust and confidence in God and the redemption that he must have provided, I know I'll see him on the last day and have a relationship with him. And so that's what it really takes, is recognizing that only God can deliver me from my inability to live up to his moral standard. And really the Christian message is this. Jesus Christ, the creator of the universe, sacrificed himself on the cross so that he could offer to every human being to trade their moral imperfection for his moral perfection. You know, when I saw that in the back of a Gideon Bible at age 19, I said, this is a good deal. I get to trade my moral imperfection for God's moral perfection. But it comes at a cost. The cost is this. I need to make the creator of the universe the master of my life. I must give up control over my life and allow him to direct my life. Now, from my perspective, that makes perfect sense. The creator of the universe, who has no immorality in him at all, obviously knows better than I do what's best for me. And so it simply makes rational sense that I let him run my life than trying to run it on my own best ideas. And so that's what becoming a Christian is all about, is simply saying, I want the offer of moral perfection in trade for my moral imperfection, and I want you to take over my life and direct my life. Now you say, how does that work? It works this way. When you make that commitment, what I love about the New Testament is that God is the one that keeps that commitment on our behalf, because I don't have the power to keep that commitment. And so he's the one that keeps it for us, and he's the one that brings the Holy Spirit into our life that step by step gives us the power and the desire to live the Christian life. And so often when I run into people that are worried, did the commitment work? My question is this, are you experiencing more desire to live the Christian life than you did a year ago or a week ago? And are you experiencing more power to walk away from sin than you did before? I'm not asking you the question, how often do you read the Bible? How often do you pray? How often do you attend church? Are you living a perfect life? No, we're not. The promise is, step by step, we get more and more desire and power. And so you should see that change at the level of your desires, and don't look so much at the behavior level.
Alan, I think God is going to honor where you're going. You're really honest with him. You're saying, if you exist, let's get on with it. And I think that's a lot more honest than a lot of people can be. I've known you a couple of years, and I've seen a change in you. I think it's coming. I think you're going to be surprised by it.
Amen. Okay, it's time for the giveaway. First thing we're going to give away is this DVD. It's called The Great Debate. That's not our title. That's the title the Skeptic Society put on it. But it is a debate that took place at Caltech at the International Skeptic Society Conference. where I debated Victor Stenger, the particle physicist and the author of the book God, the Field Hypothesis. And by the way, you can get this from the Skeptic Society for $30. Go over there at the table. We sell it for $5. We want you to see what happened in this debate. And you won't believe what Victor Stenger says at the very end of the debate. A phenomenal statement. But this is going to go free to... Can you read that?
Yeah, it's me. Imagine that.
No, I know it's not you.
Yvette Wu.
All right.
Where's Yvette?
Right there at the back.
All right.
Okay, the next one we're going to give away is a book that somebody already talked about, Why the Universe is the Way It Is. That's the basis of the DVD series that we're starting a week from tomorrow. And this is going to go to Barbara, T-I-E-M-E-I-E-R. All right. Okay. Okay, and last and probably least is this DVD called Meet Hugh Ross. And actually what it is where I get interviewed by Jeff Vines at Christ Church of the Valley for, an hour or so, and also includes some Q&A, kind of like what we're having here. And this is going to go to Brandon Bales. B-A-L-E-S, all right. Rest of you will have to go over to the book table where Colleen is. But hey, everything is discounted. Anyways, next question.
Good afternoon, Dr. Ross.
Good afternoon.
Isaiah chapter 24 titles Judgment on the Earth.
Yes.
It explains from verse 3 through 6 how there's a curse of the creation and how the world's laid waste, how it mourns and withers, it fades and withers. The earth is polluted by its inhabitants, for they transgressed laws, violated statutes, broke the everlasting covenant. I have a two-part question on this one. The polluted by its inhabitants, for they transgressed laws, violated statutes, and broke the everlasting covenant. Is that describing global warming and the rest of what's going on in the world and how the world is in a state of decay? And that's talking about the current condition of the planet now, and it's a residual effect from Genesis 1 and 2, God created the heavens and the earth, it was good. Genesis 3, the fall. So the first part of the question is this explaining the current condition of the world now due to the consequences of the fall? And the second part of the question is Revelation 21, God creates a new heavens, a new earth, a new Jerusalem. Scientifically, scripturally, however, how does God create it again? Does he wipe out the universe and the planet and he creates it all over again? Or...
Okay, two great questions. Isaiah 24 is one of several passages in the Bible that speak about conditions before the creator of the universe returns. You know, the heart of Christianity is that there's two comings of the Messiah. The first coming of the Messiah is where he sacrifices himself for the sins of the whole world. The second coming is where he comes back to set himself up as ruler of planet Earth and prepare redeemed humanity for entry into the new creation, which gets to the second part of your question. What Isaiah 24 and the passages in Ezekiel and Daniel and Revelation especially speak about the conditions just before that second coming. And basically is making the point that during that period, you'll see more and more of humanity, especially those who are, quote, the rulers and the leaders of humanity, ignoring God. And as they ignore God, they wind up mismanaging the planet. And as it says here in Isaiah 24, it'll actually get so bad that they begin to pollute themselves to death. And You know, it's Genesis chapter 1 where God speaks to Adam and Eve. And he says, I'm putting you in charge of the planet and all of its resources. And you're to manage the planet's resources for the benefit of all life. And Job 37 through to Job 42 speak about, it's kind of like God's creation care manual. In detail, it tells us how to manage the resources of the planet for the benefit of all life, particularly Job 37, which I think is the passage that pertains most to global warming. What you see in the book of Job is that God tells us to give priority to managing the precipitation patterns of the planet. You know, because what it tells us is that God gave us three different kinds of frozen precipitation and three different kinds of liquid precipitation. But for example, we're living at a time when humanity has, you know, really messed up the precipitation patterns. So for example, the Sahara Desert is 10 times bigger than it was in the days of the Romans. The Gobi Desert is 4 times bigger. In fact, the Gobi Desert is now advanced right into the suburbs of Beijing itself. And so this is starting to cause some stress, not only for humanity, but for the rest of life on the planet. And so you see references in this to Isaiah 24 and elsewhere. It talks about how the water is going to be polluted, the land will be polluted, the air will be polluted. And in fact, I was online just yesterday where they were talking about the pollution disaster that Singapore is currently facing. You can go online and see the photographs. It's so bad you can only see a few feet into the air. And they're beginning to worry about whether or not people with respiratory problems are going to survive this incident. And, you know, I've been to Shanghai and Beijing, and the air pollution is much worse than it was here in Los Angeles in the 70s. But I got here in the 70s. I remember getting off the airplane, my eyes were stinging. Well, there are places in the world where that's happening right now. So, yeah, we human beings are mismanaging the planet, and it tells us here in Isaiah 24 that mismanagement will get worse and worse as time goes on. And really what God is doing here, he is allowing humanity literally to pollute themselves to death to get their attention. In other words, we're not doing a good job at managing the planet. And it's kind of what you see in the book of Job. If you're going to manage the planet wisely for the benefit of all life, you're not going to be able to do it without God's help. But the problem is today you've got people trying to do it without God's help. And they're getting into political battles. What I love about the message of the book of Job, it says God has designed our planet. So when we seek solutions to mismanagement, those solutions are going to be optimally economic and optimally ethical. But what I see going on, say, for global warming, you've got two camps. One camp saying we have to stress the economics. The opposite camp saying we have to stress the ethics. The Bible tells us you can have both. So there is a solution where you get both. Now, the second part of your question. Okay. The Bible tells us that God created this universe as a tool in his hand to eliminate evil and suffering once and for all. And once evil and suffering are gone, the universe will have fulfilled its purpose. God will no longer have a need for it, and as he spoke it into existence, he will speak it out of existence. And there's actually some passages in the Bible that hint at how God may bring that about. Isaiah, from which you were reading, chapter 34, makes the point that at the time of the end, God's going to roll up the universe like a scroll and it'll end in a fiery heat. Now, as a physicist, that sounds like a lot like the universe is going to end in a singularity. It was birthed in a singularity, perhaps, if we interpret these passages literally, and there's some doubt about that, yeah, it could end in a singularity, which means it would no longer exist. And then God replaces it with a new creation. And if you read the last two chapters of the Bible, Revelation 21 and 22, it describes the physical conditions of the new creation. It's different dimensions. It won't be the space-time dimensions that we're used to right now. It's going to be different dimensions. It's going to be different laws of physics. You're not going to have thermodynamics operating there, or gravity, or electromagnetism. We're not going to need any of those laws of physics because sin and evil no longer exist. Because after all of us suffer the consequences of gravity, electromagnetism, and thermodynamics. I mean, because of gravity, the older we get, our chin starts to drop towards the floor. A few other body parts start dropping towards the floor as well. And as a result of electromagnetism, our skin wrinkles up. And because of the second law of thermodynamics, all of our organs and thinking and everything else begins to wear down. And my mind isn't as sharp as it was when I was in my 20s. I'm sure that's true for the rest of you as well. But in the new creation, those laws won't exist. And there will be no decay. Well, let me say this about global warming. And in fact, there's a visiting scholar at Reasons to Believe right now, Kevin Birdwell. He did his PhD on the past 50,000 years of climatology. And so he's kind of our resident global warming expert. And his point is that the physics of global warming is roughly where we were with weather forecasting 100 years ago. 100 years ago, we could tell you what the weather was going to be like tomorrow. Notice today, we can tell you what the weather is going to be like 10 days from now. We've got the technology to be much more precise about the weather. But with global warming, we're not there yet. But we're far enough along to realize that there's a natural component to global warming and there's a human component. But if you listen to his interviews that he's done with us on our website, what he tells us is that the human factor is somewhere between 20 and 80%. The natural factor is between 20 and 80%. So that explains a lot of the debate where people say, hey, it's all nature. Well, it could be largely all nature, but it'd be a mistake to say that our human activity has zero impact. We know it accounts for at least 20% of the problem, and it could account for as much as 80% of the problem. But notice the error bar is really big. So it explains a lot of the debate. But what we've done at Reasons to Believe, and you'll hear this from Kevin Birdwell as well, regardless of where the global warming comes from, there are things we can do about it that are optimally economic and optimally ethical. In other words, if we can bring the temperature of the planet down and at the same time increase the economic well-being of the planet's peoples, which is quite a sharp contrast from what we hear in Congress, for example, where they're saying we have to stop driving cars, we've got to shut down all of our factories, we've got to get used to a lower standard of living. No. Obviously, if we were to replant the Sahara Desert, that would soak up huge quantities of greenhouse gases, and that would be an economically viable part of the world. And just to recall, back in the days of the Roman Empire, what we now call the Sahara Desert fed Europe. That's where Europe got its grain. Today, there's no grain coming from the Sahara Desert. And, it took 2,000 years to make it that big, but keep in mind, most of the growth of the Sahara Desert happened in the 20th century. So the growth of the Sahara Desert was actually quite rapid, and we can reverse it probably in less than two generations. Same thing with the Gobi Desert. And that would be a big part of what we could do to resolve global warming. Hey, read the book of Job. It offers two more solutions to global warming where it boosts the economy of the world and at the same time it will bring the planet back to the condition that God gave it to us with these different kinds of precipitation. And hey, look at how God designed North and South America. Where are the highest mountains? The highest mountains are close to the tropics. So, for example, the mountains in Canada are like, 9 to 12,000 feet high. But in California, they're 14,000 feet high, which means we can have snow-capped mountains not only in British Columbia, but all the way down here into California. And if you go to Mexico, they got mountains that are 17,000 feet high. If they're only 14,000 feet high, they'd have no snow. And it's crucial that you get snow because the snow melts slowly and provides a reliable source of water for agriculture. And same thing with South America. But we could mismanage our country to such a degree where snow no longer falls on the high Sierras. And that would be ruinous to California agriculture if we no longer had a snowpack.
Dave, you got another question?
I have a write-in question here, but before I do that, I'm going to do a shameless plug for the book table here. Hugh has already referenced his book, Why the Universe Is the Way It Is, a great resource over there. If you get it at our book table, it's you get it at a discount. It's only $10. Hugh just referenced about a lot of answers in Job that answer today's questions, and also a lot about the book of nature and how animals can teach us things. Very easy to read book, very fun book, has a lot of personal things about Hugh. If you want more information about Hugh himself, obviously this is a great book, also $10. And the next one answers the question that we have a writing answer for, and that is, who is Adam? And so the person that wrote this, you can give them a brief answer, but if you want a detailed answer, get who is Adam. And the question is, who are cavemen? In other words, obviously a lot of people want to know, don't cavemen prove, that we came from, a lower life form in evolution? And that's probably where the question is leading.
Okay, who are cavemen? Modern day technocrats that build a little den with a TV set where they've got a little refrigerator where they can close themselves off from the rest of the family. Okay, that's all joking aside.
Are you saying Laker fans are cavemen?
Some Laker fans are cavemen. My sons are cavemen now because their eyes are glued to the hockey games that are going on. But anyways. But that's the whole point, is that humans have always lived in caves. I mean, that's not something that's unusual. When people usually talk about cavemen, they're typically referring to the bipedal primates who, unlike us, did not have a spiritual component to them. So I imagine it's a reference to things like Neanderthals. By the way, Cro-Magnon is a term that's dropped from the scientific literature. Cro-Magnon, we now realize, is fully human. Cro-Magnon, that's usually a reference to people who were living 10 to 30,000 years ago. But now we realize that, according to the Bible itself, humanity must have been around for at least 30, 40,000 years, if for no other reason to explain why those four rivers in Genesis 2 were flowing on dry land. The only location on planet Earth where those four rivers come together is what's now part of the Persian Gulf. But hey, if you go back in the days when the Ice Age was still in force, the Persian Gulf was largely dry land. But what about the bipedal primates that preceded human beings? Well, with Neanderthals, for example, they were on the Earth roughly 150,000 years ago to about 40,000 years ago. Or 48,000 years ago is now the latest numbers to when they disappeared from the scene. And we now realize that Neanderthals and humans did not have contact with one another, because Neanderthals lived in Europe and Siberia, and humans didn't enter that area until about 40,000 years ago. So it was about an 8,000-year gap between the last of the Neanderthals and the first of the humans entering their habitat area. But what do we know about the Neanderthals? We know that their DNA did not change, because we've got DNA over their whole geographical range and their whole historical range, and we can't measure significant change in the DNA. Incidentally, that's also true of human DNA. They've dug up humans that have been dead for 30, 35,000 years and compared their DNA with modern DNA, and we can't see a significant difference. Now, this is important because it means that the human DNA has experienced very little evolution, and likewise the Neanderthal DNA has experienced very little evolution. And there's experiments that have been done in conservation biology which shows that if a mammal weighs more than 7 pounds in its adult body size, it will go extinct before it experiences significant evolution. 8 million years, we can't measure any change in the bone structure. And that's true of all the species of bipedal primates that preceded human beings. We see no evidence that those individual species evolved. Moreover, as we look at the family of these bipedal primates, there's about 10 to 12 different species. From an evolutionary paradigm, you would anticipate that the brain size would get gradually bigger and bigger, and the bipedal capability would gradually get more and more human-like. But we don't see that. What we see, for example, is some of the later species of these bipedal primates having smaller brain sizes than ones that preceded them. And so, in fact, if you read our book, Who is Adam?, you'll see the comment, not from us, but from leading anthropologists, that every time we discover a new bipedal primate species, it throws the evolutionary paradigm into greater chaos than we had before. So, in that sense, they were like the birds and mammals. They had bodies. They had mind, will, and emotions, just like your dog and cat does, but they lacked the spirit dimension. And moreover, they lacked any ability to advance technology. The thing that's unique to human beings, when we show up, there is an immediate technological explosion. In fact, they refer to this as the cultural big bangs. So when humans show up, they're wearing clothes almost immediately. We're the only species that wears clothes willingly. I mean, I know people dress their dogs, but you don't see dogs or horses making clothes and wearing them. That's unique to human beings. Neanderthals were naked. They did not have any tools or apparently need to make clothing. Their bodies were designed for a cold climate. By the way, the human body is designed for a warm climate. We're wonderfully designed to live in a warm climate. Neanderthals had short limbs, barrel-shaped bodies, and huge nasal capacities, which is what you need when you're living in a cool climate. But we humans were very quickly able to live in areas much colder than the Neanderthals. Why? Because we wore clothes. And so we were able to overcome the human limitations to be able to operate. And so when it's in a hot place, we can wear a few clothes. When it's warm, we put on lots of clothes. I'm from Canada. I've been in places where you had to wear special parkas, which had a tube going out like this, so it warmed the air before it got to your nose. Otherwise, you'd be freezing your nasal passages. That happens when the temperature hits about 45 below. I imagine here not many of you experience that kind of a temperature.
So. Oh,
yeah. They survive that weather, but only with special clothing. You have to have, you know, specifically designed clothing to be able to survive under those extreme conditions. But let me just add this a little bit. We now know, in fact, it came through Ian Tattersall and some other atheist anthropologists, the reason why we have all these bipedal primates. What we've been able to document is that those continents that had them, when humans came upon the scene, the extinction rate of large-bodied bird and mammals was slight. But those continents that lacked those bipedal primates, it was extreme. So, for example, in sub-Sahara Africa, which had the full complement of these bipedal primate species existing for 6.5 million years, the extinction rate when humans entered that area was 4.5%, whereas in Australia it was 86%, which explains why the Australians were not able to get out of the Stone Age. The Aborigines never got out of the Stone Age. North America, the extinction rate was 73%. There were horses here in North America. There were camels here in North America. But when people came into North America, they killed them off. And hence, the Indians and the Eskimos never got out of the Stone Age. Likewise, South America. But notice it didn't happen in Europe, Asia, and Africa, where they had the full complement of those bipedal primates. So that's another thing you can thank God for in Thanksgiving, that God created those Neanderthals and Homo erectus and Australopithecines so we could actually have turkeys, for example, on our dinner table. Anyway, go ahead.
I'd just like a little clarification on your graph there.
Yes.
I thought you said there were 14 measurements, but I only see 8 dots.
Well, those last 2 dots, there's a whole bunch of measurements there.
Oh, okay. And then I see 2 UFOs up there.
Oh, yeah. Those are upper limits. And you know, the reason why I left that on the graph is what used to be an upper limit has now become our best measurement of the past temperature of the universe. So basically, astronomers went back to the same galaxy and using better technology, instead of getting an upper limit, they actually got a real measurement with a very tiny error bar.
Well, you mean there's measurements up there that aren't on the graph?
Okay, you'll see those two little bars with an arrow pointing down.
Yeah.
That simply means that the astronomers who made that measurement were able to determine the temperature couldn't be any greater than that value, but it could be less.
Oh.
And so the error bar was so large, all they could give you was an upper limit.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Takes an engineer to ask those kinds of questions. Yeah, go ahead.
Well, you have another engineer. I'm from the Midwest where they have all that nature, so from
Thank
a farm,
you.
So I've seen a lot of nature. Anyway, my question is about the Level 2 multiverse. It proposes an infinitely increasing number of universes with different physical constants, and most scientists agree that even if there is a multiverse, it still had to have a beginning.
Correct.
And my question is, if the Level 2 multiverse actually exists, does the math require all those increasingly infinite number of universes came about at the same time, or could they have come about sequentially one after another, or does time even make sense? Because time doesn't start until the universe starts, apparently. And so my question would be, how do we know we're not like the very first universe, or we're the quadrillionth universe, or where do we fit within that? And is that an argument a little bit against the probability of an infinite number of universe creating the fine-tuning?
Okay. I'll keep my comments brief because we have a lot of material on this on our website, and one of our reasons to believe scientist Jeff Zwirink, an astrophysicist, has written a booklet on this called Who's Afraid of the Multiverse? And you are correct that no matter what kind of multiverse theory you speculate, it's still subject to the space-time theorem published by Arvind Bordé, Alexander Blinken, and Alan Guth, which basically says life is only possible in an expanding universe, and if you're living in an expanding universe, it must have a space-time beginning and a causal agent beyond space and time that brings about the universe or the multiverse. So all multiverse models are subject to the space-time theorems. And if you were to read Lawrence Krauss's latest defense of atheism, A Universe from Nothing, you have to read about 80% of the way through the book, but you actually see a statement in the book that because of these space-time theorems, we cannot discount a deistic interpretation of the universe. And that's really what's going on with the leading atheist scientists these days. They're conceding a deistic worldview, but they're not conceding a theistic worldview. They're claiming, yes, there is some kind of God or laws of physics generator, to use their terminology, that brings the universe into existence, sets up the math and the physics, but they're adamant in saying that that causal agent is not a personal being, which is why they invoke the multiverse. The multiverse is being invoked not to eliminate the need for God, but as an attempt to eliminate the need for a personal God. And so what they're saying is all this fine-tuning design we see is not the product of a personal being, it's the product of pure chance. That if you've got an infinite number of universes, and Yonsu said the second level of multiverse, which is basically saying it's not just a lot of universes out there, it's actually universes of such great infinite abundance that literally every feature, every possible combination of the laws of physics and the gross features of the universe would be represented. And I've written about this, that really requires an infinite number of an infinite number of universes. And then they say, because every possible set of the laws of physics and the features of the universe are represented, they argue that the features of our universe and the laws of physics are the product of pure chance. We just happen to be living in the lucky universe where everything is just right for our existence.
Do they all pop? If it's true, do they all pop out at once?
They could all pop out at once, but there could also be a time delay. They don't all have to pop out at once. And this is why Alan Guth, for example, in reference to the multiverse, said it's speculation squared. Okay? Reason why is general relativity, which is now the most exhaustively tested and best proven principle in physics, establishes that once you get a universe where you have the possibility of observers, its space-time manifold takes the characteristic that no matter how many other universes exist, that space-time envelope cannot touch or overlap the space-time envelope of any other possibly existing universe, which means there's no way that humans can ever prove the existence of a second universe. We can speculate, but we can't prove. And, you know, the speculations are particularly rife in what's called Physics Letters B. It's a journal dedicated to these kinds of speculations, mainly to stimulate exotic mathematics. And so people are playing around with different space-time constructs. And depending on those constructs, it could go either way. But let me explain to you why this is a self-defeating argument for atheism. Number one, notice no atheist ever brought up this idea until the evidence for fine-tuning design, in the words of Paul Davies, became overwhelming. So they were reluctant to go there until they were forced to go there. In fact, what I've written is that from an atheistic perspective, or a person, say, trying to deny a personal God, there's nowhere else to go except the second level multiverse or the third level multiverse. There are no other options. But notice they were reluctant to go there. And this is why they're reluctant to go there. If you're going to appeal to a second level multiverse to avoid a personal God, that would also predict that you not only have one planet like Earth, you'd have an infinite number of planets like Earth. And those infinite number of planets, you'd have an infinite number of beaches with random markings in the sand. And one of those beaches, the random markings are going to be identical to all the research papers published by Stephen Hawking, in which case those papers are not the product of a mind, they're a product of pure chance. Now, no scientist thinks that way. No human being thinks that way. We really do believe that what we create is a product of our mind and not the product of random, unthinking, unconscious processes. So that's why it's a self-defeating argument. But let me put a positive spin on it. There's a way to test the second and third level multiverse as an attempt to avoid a personal God. If there is no personal God, then we would anticipate that the more measurements we make in the universe, we're going to either see stasis in the evidence for fine-tuning design, or we're going to see a decline in the evidence for fine-tuning design. But if the evidence continues to get stronger and stronger for fine-tuning design, then that tells us we really are looking at a personal creator. Now, I've written several books on what's called the anthropic principle, this evidence for design in the universe. But most of the books are written by people who are not Christians. There's over 50 books written by physicists and astronomers on this. What's unique about our material is we look for this design not just at the level of the universe, but at the level of our cluster of galaxies, at the level of our galaxy, our solar system, our planet Earth, the life on planet Earth, the interior of the Earth, making the point at the level of the particle physics. No matter what size scale you look at, you see this overwhelming evidence for design. And I think what's going on amongst my non-believing peers, they only want to look at it at the largest possible scale, because that way things don't get too personal. But the truth is, we see it at all size levels, which means, based on what we see, if we were able to see other universes, chances are we're going to see fine-tuning design there as well, because we see it at all other size levels of this creation in which we live. So the burden of proof, scientifically, is on those who say it's not there. Going up one more level is not going to get rid of it, because we see it at all levels. And by the way, you'll see a 300-page compendium on our website, free access, where we document this design at all these different levels. So, in that sense, there really is a personal creator out there.
So what you're saying, Hugh, is that the multiverse idea is embraced by scientists who pride themselves on being on following the evidence. It's being embraced for philosophical reasons, not for reasons that they can't ever see. There's never going to be any evidence for it.
Well, one caveat to that is the evidence for the level one universe is growing, because we now know, thanks to the Planck satellite, that there was an early inflationary event to the universe. And the simplest of those inflationary models predicts that you would actually get many space-time bubbles coming out rather than a single space-time bubble. Now, as future releases of the Planck satellite come out, I'm quite hopeful we're going to be able to nail down what kind of inflationary event happened in the early history of the universe. But it's already established in Christian theology that God did not limit himself to one space-time realm. After all, he created a different realm for the angels. You've got heaven, you've got hell, which survived God eliminating the space-time realm of our universe. Now, whether it's space-time dimensions, I don't know, but clearly God has created more than one realm. And how many? Well, we know it's a few, but it could be a whole lot. And so in that sense, the multiverse has always been a Christian doctrine. You can read the literature of the Middle Ages theologians. They were writing about what we now call the multiverse. What my colleague Jeff Zwirink has done in his booklet is to show that from a Christian perspective, the multiverse is self-consistent and free of contradictions. But from an atheistic perspective, it's loaded with contradictions. And I just gave one example of how it's self-defeating. There's actually several examples of how the atheistic version is a self-defeating argument. But in a Christian context, it makes sense. That's why he titled the book, Who's Afraid of the Multiverse? We already know that the multiverse concept is correct, at least in some contexts. The question is, what kind of multiverse do we live in, and how does it testify of God? And one of the things that excites me, we're now learning in terms of the inflationary event. The inflationary event is fine-tuned to make life possible. We human beings could not exist unless God hyperinflated the universe when the universe was 10 to the minus 34 seconds old. And it was crucial that he stopped the hyperinflation at just the right time. And so as the Planck satellite continues to give us more data, I think we're going to find some really amazing fine-tuning evidence that we don't have right now.
So the evidence for a creator just gets bigger and bigger and bigger.
Amen.
David?
You mentioned earlier that while there are two camps on global warming, one saying that we need to make things hard for the economy, and the other saying we need to make abuse ethics.
Mm-hmm.
There's a third solution that doesn't
require
any compromise.
Right.
Could you describe what that might look like?
Well, I'll give you a couple more examples. I mean, one example I gave you is that, you know, we could replant the Sahara and Gobi deserts. And if we were to do that, the vegetation there would soak up greenhouse gases. That's what vegetation does. It takes carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere and makes sugars, starches, and fats. So that's one thing we can do to resolve global warming. And if we do that, it would boost the economy of Africa and that part of Asia. So it's like a win-win. Everybody wins if we do it. In fact, I suggested in my book that we might go so far as to say to the sub-Saharan peoples, we're going to give you all the petroleum you want free of charge. Use it any way you want to use it, on the condition you work with us to replant the Sahara Desert. You know, when I was a young man growing up, the Sahara Desert was moving south at a rate of 6 miles a year. That's how fast it's been growing in the 20th century. It is slowing down now, but we could literally do the reverse, where we push the Sahara Desert back by 6 miles a year. In fact, it can be done at an even more rapid rate than that, which means in a relatively short term, we could have that part of Africa growing wheat again and soaking up greenhouse gases. A couple of other examples you get from the book of Job. It gives you a top 10 list of animals. and basically says, I gave you these animals to launch civilization. And what's interesting is we humans in the 21st century think we got a high technology global civilization by our own effort. The message of the book of Job is you wouldn't have made it unless God had specially designed these animals to help you launch civilization. So it talks about the horse, for example, and the cow and the donkey. Talks about the goat. And these are all creatures that were crucial for getting human civilization into an advanced agricultural state so they could actually employ people as engineers and scientists and get the kind of technology today. But the evidence is those people that lacked those animals never got out of the Stone Age. So we didn't do it all by ourselves. It was thanks to these animals that it made it happen. But one of the things it tells us about the cow is that God gave us a cow to perform heavy labor, and talks about how the cow actually enjoys doing heavy labor. And those of you who have been in farms have probably witnessed this. A cow is happiest when it's doing heavy labor for its human owner. Now, that may not be true of your children, but it is true of the cows, okay? But today, we don't really use cows to do heavy labor. We use cows for meat. And one other animal that's in that top 10 list is the ostrich. And one thing modern research is bringing out is that ostriches produce red meat just like beef does. Only it's far healthier than beef. It's one of the lowest cholesterol, lowest saturated fat meats you can get. And moreover, economists have demonstrated that if you actually raise ostriches the right way, you can get the meat for about one-fifth the price of beef. So hey, now you've got a cheap source of red meat that people are going to like. It's really healthy. The problem is there's so little ostrich meat available today, it's basically doled out to diabetics only. But the truth is we would all benefit from switching from beef to ostrich meat. However, the Bible also talks about some of the characteristics of ostriches. I mean, they like to bond to humans. In fact, I know some people who tried raising ostriches and failed because they treated them like cows. You can't treat them like cows. That's the message of the book of Job. God designed each of these creatures to relate to us human beings in a different way. And, you know, a cow, you can leave it out there in the field and ignore it for a couple of months at a time, and it'll be fine. You can't do that with ostriches. They take a higher level of human contact than the beef does. But it would provide you. And the thing we notice about ostriches, they release very little greenhouse gases to the atmosphere. Whereas cows, in terms of human contribution to global warming, they're at the top of the list. Why? Because we've bred these cows to be able to produce, 86 quarts of milk a day? Well, they didn't used to make that much milk. We've bred them to make that much milk. But one of the consequences is to get that much milk, the cow is releasing an order of magnitude more methane into the atmosphere than one has not been bred that way. And so we have a global warming problem because of these cows. But hey, if we switch out the cows and use them for heavy labor like we used to use them and rely on the ostriches for the meat, that would be a huge contribution to global warming. Then the book of Job also talks about whales. And there's a little story in my book about how people used to think if we wipe out the whales, that would be a good thing for global warming. Why? Because whales weigh 50 to 100 tons. They're animals. They breathe in oxygen. They expel carbon dioxide. And people actually calculated how much carbon dioxide whales pump into the atmosphere. It's a huge amount in pre-industrial terms. And they said it's actually a good thing that we've been wiping out the whales. But there's a group of researchers in Australia that said, actually, the whales are a net contributor to resolving global warming. Yes, they release carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, but they're the one animal that defecates soluble iron minerals into the photic zone of the ocean. And it's that iron that limits the quantity of phytoplankton you have in the oceans. And phytoplankton make up 70% of the photosynthetic life on planet Earth. And so by boosting the population of phytoplankton through these whales fertilizing the photic zone, you wind up with all these phytoplankton sucking huge quantities of carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. At the same time, it produces a food supply for the zooplankton, which produces a food supply for the fish, which provides a food supply for the giant squid, and the sperm whales feed on the giant squid. You say, how did they discover this? Well, they noticed that the population of sperm whales was going up. But when the population of sperm whales went up, the population of giant squid went up. They said, this is weird. The only animal that feeds on giant squid are sperm whales, yet now that we got more sperm whales, we got more giant squid. And what they discovered is, because the sperm whales are fertilizing the photic zone, it's more food for the entire food chain. So the giant squid actually have more to eat thanks to the whales. What I love about it, it shows you the wonderful design of the Creator and the way He's put life in the oceans so that everybody wins. But we win too, because if we can get those whales back to where they were during the Industrial Revolution era, we're still a factor of 10 away. There were 10 times as many whales in the oceans 250 years ago than there is right now. And if we can bring the whale population back, it would be a huge contribution to global warming and would also restore our fishing stocks, which have been sadly depleted.
Hugh, this is going to be our last question.
Hi. Can either one of you expand on the concept of non-locality? And also, are you aware of any experiments that would prove or disprove consciousness beyond the body? I'm sorry, I'm taking you off track here.
Well, okay. I think what you mean by non-locality are these experiments in quantum mechanics that may be indicating that we human beings have some exquisite control over the quantum area. I mean, some people have been speculating along those lines. Other physicists have made the opposite conclusion. No, this is demonstrating that there are serious limits to what we can know at the quantum era. And that's actually the correct deduction from these experiments, that yes, there are really strange things happening when we see the indeterminacy of quantum mechanics being transformed into determinacy. And so you get things like the Schrödinger's cat analogy. And what's really going on, however, is that because of the Heisenberg uncertainty principle, we can't investigate or explore the transition from indeterminacy to determinacy. So to give you an example, I could take a coin and put it upright and spin it around very rapidly, and I don't know whether it's going to be heads or tails. But I could do an experiment, like take my hand and smash it on that spinning coin, that will force it into heads or tails. But I really can't explore ahead of time whether it's going to land up heads or tails. I can make it happen, but I can't investigate the transition from indeterminacy to determinacy. That's kind of a crude analogy to the limitations that are going on in the quantum era. But I think what's most fascinating from a Christian perspective is that the indeterminacy is crucial for life to exist. And we actually see indeterminacy in statistical mechanics as well as quantum mechanics. And in both cases, the indeterminacy is fine-tuned. So in statistical mechanics, for example, it would explain Brownian movement. Well, Brownian movement is crucial to make certain engines or machines inside the cell to operate. And likewise, in our body, we have proteins that act as transistors. And if the uncertainty were bigger, those transistors would fail. If the uncertainty was less than the Heisenberg number, it would also fail. The uncertainty is fine-tuned. Making any bigger, any less, then these proteins will fail to function and no life will be possible here on planet Earth. So the answer to the big question, who was right, Einstein or Bohr? Bohr said God plays with dice. Einstein said God does not play with dice. The answer is he really does play with dice, but he very carefully designs the dice to get exactly the results he wants. And from a God perspective, he can see the indeterminacy being transformed into determinacy because he's not limited by space and time. But because we human beings are limited by space and time, we can't see what God sees, which is a beautiful proof that we can never become like God. Okay, now you had another question, but I didn't quite catch it. Do you remember what her second question was?
Yeah, she's asking about non-physical consciousness, which sort of goes to the near-death experience.
Well, there is experiments that have been done to show that only humans are sinners. There used to be some speculation, for example, that dogs are spiritual, just like we human beings are spiritual. Because after all, when they do something wrong, they repent and take on a guilty look. And those of you who have had dogs know that dogs do that. And so it was a research group at Boston University that decided to put this to the test. And then what they discovered is the dog is simply responding to the human response. And the thing about dogs is, and what makes them so endearing, is they can read our facial expressions. We got cats in our home, and they're not very good at that at all. But dogs, they can read your emotional state by looking at your face. And likewise, dogs have the ability to take on facial expressions. Our family has a dog, and the dog quickly figured out that we enjoy smiles. So the dog smiles at us. Well, most dogs won't smile. But this dog wanting to please us says, oh, they like smiles. They smile at one another. This is one way I can make them happier. I'll smile too. Well, likewise, that's what a dog does. If he sees a reproving look on your face, he says, oh, my owner wants me to look like I'm in a repentant state. And so they'll take on that expression. And what they discovered in this Boston University experiment, it's got nothing to do with what the dog does. Because they can get the dog to take on the guilty look, even if it did the right thing. And also they discovered that they could even have a non-human come in with that look, and it will take on that feature as well. And so it's simply trying to make you happy. It's not admitting that it's done anything wrong. It's only we human beings that actually have a sense of morality. And it's that sense of morality which I'd argue scientifically proves that we are spiritual beings and the animals are not. So it's one example of tests that have been done. In my book on Job, I describe a number of other experiments that show that we human beings really are distinct from animals and that we have a human component. Now, what you may be alluding to is something that's still undergoing. Can we prove that we have life after death? And that can't be scientifically established yet, but as we've been alluding about these out-of-body experiences, there is research that's getting in that area. We don't have the book here, but we have a book on UFOs. That also makes it clear that there is now scientific evidence that there must be beings who are not subject to our space-time realm that are, you know, interfering with human existence. So there is hard scientific evidence that really does demonstrate that there's a spiritual component to humanity that we alone amongst all species of life possess.
All right. Thank you, Hugh. Before we wind up, I want to remind you of several things. A week from tomorrow night, July 1st at 7 o'clock, the meeting of the L.A. Chapter of Reasons to Believe, where we're going through Hugh's video series, which matches the book, Why the Universe is the Way It Is. You're all welcome. Love to see you there. Paradox class in general, 11:15 every Sunday morning at this church. And that's it. Let's give Dr. Ross a big hand. Thank you. And thank you, everybody, for coming.